Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Central Ohio housing market remains hot. That's good news if you're in the market to sell, not so much if you're looking to buy. We're talking about what's working and what's not in real estate. Joining us is Worthington-based realtor with Keller Williams Capital Partners, Cynthia McKenzie. Welcome back.
Thanks, Ann.
Also with us, real estate analyst at Vogt Strategic Insights, Rob Vogt. Welcome back, Rob.
Morning, Ann.
And president of Heltbringer Mortgage Services, Todd Heltbringer. Welcome back, Todd.
Good morning. Thank you.
Todd, an anticipated Federal Reserve interest rate hike is the centerpiece of this week's economic news.
Yes.
How much of the market activity is due to the continued low interest rates?
Well, you know, talking about the Fed raising rates, I don't think they're going to do anything.
Oh, you don't think it's going to happen? Okay.
Even if they do something, if they raise rates, our rates follow the 10-year bond market, and it is touching so much of the economy that them to raise rates up. Right now, the current 30-year fix is 3 7/8. If they were to take the rates to 4.5%, 5%, you want to see the economy spiral out of control. It will. So I just think what the Fed is going to do, if they raise their rates, is going to adjust for prime, credit cards, student loans, things like that. It's not really going to affect the housing because, again, it's a different mechanism. We use the bond market, and they're basically using prime lending.
Kind of a different mechanism.
But I just don't see whatever they do affecting our interest rates.
So you don't think they're headed up at all?
I think they might go up gradually. When I say gradually...
Well, it already is up gradually. It's up,
well,
what, one...
3 7/8. We were at 3.5.
Yeah.
You know, so still, anybody that comes to me now and says, the rates are so high, I know their age.
So, no kidding.
Yeah. I mean, rates, who would imagine you could borrow... That's, you know, $424,000 at under 4% and still get a tax deduction. I mean, it's incredible. So will they go up? Maybe they do, but I don't see them much more than 4.5 at the highest.
Well, it's it's not just the rates are low. It's they've been low for so long.
Exactly.
Like as you said, when someone says they're high, it tells you their age because, as I said many times, my first house, I think it was around 7% or more. Yeah.
So are they making lending requirements tougher now, Todd, or how are we doing
on
that side?
Are they still?
Well, no doc loans?
Only for you. There are no doc loans, and I hope the no doc never comes back.
No doc.
Where basically, there used to be a loan out there where they wouldn't verify your income, your assets, employment, nothing. I mean, basically, it was fog a mirror, get a mortgage. Mm-hmm. And that was the disaster that we had. I mean, there's a lot of things in place with the Dodd-Frank consumer finance that there are things out there that are in place that we can't lend to somebody unless they have certain ratios. I think it's a little stringent, but I don't think it's overly burdened. I mean, there's basically six items that we need to collect from a client, and it's everything they should have: tax return, pay stub, W-2. I mean, and then from there, we can just basically see, are you approved or not? There's a ton more disclosures, I think, meaning this is a fixed rate. There's no prepayment penalties. You're given that about 15 different times, so they're hoping people understand this is the payment you'll be paying every month. So a ton more disclosures, which is... When I first started in this industry, we had 4 disclosures. Mm-hmm. Now there's 56 pages of disclosures.
Is it – so it makes it sound like it's harder to buy, get that first loan at least.
I think a challenge that a lot of the first-time home buyers have is coming up with a down payment.
Okay.
And that's gone
up
significantly.
Same old problem.
Yeah, for sure. And then I think the people that are already in their first house looking to move to their second house – they now have some equity in their house, but trying to figure out how to buy before they sell,
right?
It does get complicated quickly.
Yeah, the buying before you're selling, that is if you can find something. I mean, it's tight out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I will say one thing, you know, Cynthia, about what I've noticed more is the parents have a lot more money and are willing to help out the child. And so, like, I agree with your saying that going in contingent on the sale of your home just doesn't work. So a lot of parents will say, I'll go ahead and gift you the next down payment. And then when you sell your house, you know, wink, wink, yeah, you're supposed to pay me back.
And there's another problem with the parents, Todd.
The kid is supposed to pay the parent back, right?
The parents aren't moving. And that's one of the problems we have is the baby boomers are sitting in their house. They can't find a place to move up into or move down towards.
Right.
So they're sitting there and not turning over some of this product that we need to open it up for some of the younger buyers. So it's a real problem.
How about
the
product?
And I just read a stat. I'm sorry. I just read a statistic that the average tenure of a home now is 10 years, and that's up 3 years.
That average is just 10 years?
Yeah.
Hmm. You think it would be.
That's for homeowners.
Mm-hmm, for homeowners.
And do you think it is because there's nowhere to go?
Yes.
For a lot of people.
For a lot of people, for sure.
What's missing out there? You can rent.
There's a lot of rental choices out there now, and in fact, we're going to have a lot more as time goes on. I think next spring and summer, we're going to see an awful lot of product being released into the market, so you'll have a lot of choices.
Good stuff? I mean, the kind of things that someone's going to be willing to leave their Worthington house for?
I think so. In fact, there's some developers who are targeting empty nesters. They're actually building projects specifically for them. And I think that was part of the problem is that a lot of empty nesters didn't find a place that they wanted to or liked to move towards. And I think that developers are recognizing that. I think with the amount of product that we've got going on in the Short North and downtown, we'll see more and more older adults migrating to that product type. So maybe that will shake loose some of the houses that are occupied by the boomers in the suburbs.
Yeah, well, they want to rent or own.
Well, that's exactly my question.
That's right.
That's the question.
Right. We have a little bit of both. So if I've got an empty nester in a house, sometimes they'll want to make their retirement in the next 5 to 7 years, but mm-hmm. they're also tired of being homeowners. So that's where the downtown rental is win-win. They can go downtown, be free to go to wherever they're going to go after they retire without having their house to sell as an obstacle.
And I've been kind of surprised at how slow the condominium market has taken to come back. Now, some of that is a supply issue that we don't have a lot of choices
right.
as a condominium, but we're finding more and more older adults embracing the idea of renting. The fact that they can go into a neighborhood, try it out for a couple of years. If they like it, stay there, maybe buy something. If they don't like it, then get up and move someplace else. So I think we're going to see a lot more older adults migrating towards rentals as giving them the flexibility that they're looking for in terms of trying things out before they buy.
But what about turning over the capital gains? I mean, a lot of people, what do you do with that then?
They won't have capital gains if it's their primary residence. You will not have a capital gain.
But if you sell,
it's your primary residence.
Gotcha.
Yeah,
okay.
If they were doing like rental properties or commercial properties, yeah, they'd have to worry about the reinvestment, but not with your primary residence.
You can sell and the money's yours, and you don't have to. Okay,
yep.
All right.
That's so you can travel and
travel. I do agree with your idea of if you've been a homeowner in that house for 20 years and you want to go down and rent someplace, what a great idea to try that area for 2 years because it's a lifestyle change, whereas you had a yard, you had your neighbors, and now you're going down to a building where you have to go out a hallway. You might not like that.
You may not. That's right.
It's a big difference. But, if you change your mind a year later and say,
right.
we do want to buy, then you're up the creek. There is not a lot on the market still.
Yeah. And I don't see a lot, Cynthia, I don't see a lot of new builds coming online. And that's not the market that we really play in, the new build market. But I don't see a ton of new homes being built.
Yeah.
Do you?
There's definitely not as many as we need.
That's right. That's the challenge today for builders is you can't build anything for less than $250,000 or $60,000. And those places that they're building new houses is not necessarily the places that younger buyers want to live in.
Yeah.
They want to be close to where they work, close to where they shop, places to go and go out to dinner. And when you're living several miles out in the suburbs someplace, that's not a great choice for them. So that's one of the reasons I think we're stuck in sort of this neutral position that we are right now, that we don't have the product in the places that they want to be. And it's going to be I don't see it clearing up into the future. I mean, regulations out in the suburbs are dictating the cost of land, mm-hmm. The cost of building a properly zoned product and the cost of materials now with all the disasters that we're faced with. So it's going to be challenging, I think, for the next several years.
Anything inside the Beltway is pretty good shape.
For sure. Still high demand. I think even some of the suburbs like Worthington and Grandview and Dublin, they're all trying to get more of that urban feel for buyers to like, the walkability.
Right. Big deal.
But the supply is low everywhere.
Yeah.
We've
talked about that a lot, that right now, if a house goes on the market, I mean, you'll have 10 bids on it, 20 bids on it in a couple of days. It's just insane.
I was surprised that and I'm not going to name names or anything, but I see a property on the market. It's been on the market for like 2 months in Worthington. Nothing else lasts more than 48 hours. What do they do? I mean, is that where they're just priced at high? People have been getting cocky and they just overpriced?
That can happen. Price and condition are generally the two reasons that something won't sell. They're also, depending on the price point, if you're getting into Worthington above a certain price point, there's just not different. As many buyers because you're also then competing with Upper Arlington, Bexley,
right.
where there's a lot more choice above 800.
Okay. I just, everything's moving so fast. It's a bidding war out there. Yeah.
I would say fast is anything under 400. It's fast. But I do agree, Cynthia. You know, anything five and greater, there's just a smaller pool of people that want those, you know, 6,000 square foot houses. I mean, people, as we talked years ago, you know, people want that smaller home where they can go wherever they want to go and not have 6,000 square feet to take care of all the time.
And also, money is cheap, right? So for lack of a better term, so if a house needs a lot of improvements, it's going to be less attractive to a lot of buyers because if you can buy a house all the way ready to move into and not have a lot of cash out of pocket, except for your 10% down payment or 20%, that's going to be more attractive to a lot of buyers.
Trulia said that Columbus is one of the 10 markets on the move. And I'm just wondering, where can it go? What's left?
I think it's growing more towards what like Rob
More the rental side.
Rob
Vogt?
Yeah, we are seeing an unprecedented amount of new apartment construction in Central Ohio. I don't think we have seen these types of construction activities since the heydays of baby boomers moving out to the suburbs. I mean, anyone just drive through the short north to see the incredible additions to the multifamily product that's going on. So, I think that's one area that we're experiencing just an incredible boom. You know, you guys were talking about where people are going to move to. We have to think about where is the vacant land, where is it zoned, where are the utilities, where are the schools located, and then how much is that site going to cost in order to develop it? And I think that's one of the challenges that, again, that builders are having today, that even though our market's on the move, we're kind of running up against a glass ceiling where do we go? We just don't have those kinds of suburbs to accommodate the kind of growth we're looking at. And at least at the price point that we're talking about, you know, you guys were talking about how successful things going on inside the Beltway are doing here in Columbus. But, you know, we've got a lot of neighborhoods in Columbus that has a lot of product there that could become desirable and is very, very affordable. The problem is we can't get folks interested in some of those neighborhoods. So you've got to take kind of this impact of what's going on in real estate with a bit of a grain of salt because it's who are you talking about? What neighborhoods are you talking about? What price point are you talking about? So it's a really loaded question, and it's going to be a challenge for a long, long time to develop the kind of housing that we want, where we want to be.
What, as far as rental goes, what are the must-haves? What are people looking for? I was reading somewhere where everything has a balcony now, but...
Well, you're right. And I think outdoor space is important to a lot of folks, whether they are buyers or renters. I mean, I think it's important that if an apartment's going to come online, generally you're going to have a balcony or some sort of outdoor patio. It's expensive to build that kind of space for renters, but it's one of the things they demand. You know, the upscale appliances, the walk-in closet, the exercise facility, the swimming pool. And that's one of the reasons that we're finding a lot of millennials staying in an apartment because the kind of amenity that you get in an upscale apartment is a heck of a lot better than you can buy in a you can find in a house someplace. So why not stay in that apartment for a while and pay off bills and things like that?
I never got to that fancy apartment stage. I kind of just bypassed that.
Well, you know, when we were sort of growing up, luxury apartments really didn't exist in the way they do today. And you know, if you go downtown and look at some of the new rental products coming online, it will blow your mind on what it offers. It's really first rate.
My backdoor neighbor rents a place around campus while she's in school that has a nicer kitchen than I do.
Well, that is that's right. That's one of the strategies that apartment developers are doing is building towards that student market.
Mm-hmm. You know, are they getting spoiled though?
You know, I think it is a little bit of a downer when your first time home buyer comes to you with their list of what they're looking for because they have two full bathrooms, they have X, Y, and Z, and you start showing them houses. Oh, well, we can
and
do
they want to be inside the Beltway and blah, blah, blah.
Three bedroom, one bath for $280, and they're going to be paying as much or more than their apartment rent.
But of course,
but their ownership, and I do think there's a lot. They want to control their space. They want the pride of ownership. They want the community. So most of them understand they're going to have to take a step back in the bedrooms and bathrooms.
And walk-in closets and so on and so forth.
The closets, for sure.
We are We are talking about real estate today. If you have any questions or comments, you're certainly welcome to call. We have Rob Vogt. He's real estate analyst at Vogt Strategic Insights. Also, Cynthia McKenzie, Worthington-based with Keller Williams Capital Partners, and Todd Helbringer, president of Helbringer Mortgage Services. If you have a question, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the real estate market in Central Ohio this hour. If you're looking to buy or sell in the spring, now is the time to plot your strategy. Still with us is President of Helbringer Mortgage Services, Todd Helbringer. Todd, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
And also with us, real estate analyst at Vogt Strategic Insights, Rob Vogt. Thanks again, Rob.
You're welcome.
And Worthington-based realtor and owner with Keller Williams Capital Partners.
Not owner.
Okay, sorry.
But thank you.
Cynthia McKenzie, thanks for
Ann.
Joining us. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org if you have a question or comment. A survey by Value Insured says that 4 out of 5 Americans think now is a good time to sell. And when they say now, is that right now or in the near future? Say spring. What are we talking about? I mean, it's the holidays.
It is the holidays, and we're still seeing strong demand.
Okay.
So if someone is ready to put their house on the market or their condo on the market, I would not discourage them to do so in December. One of my buyers just was one of 3 offers on a condo that, yay, we got. So it's still a very strong market.
Wow.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, we were talking earlier that some of our largest months have been November, December, and January in closings. So I think, back to Cynthia's comment, that if you want to sell your house, put it on the market right now. If it's priced properly, looks good, there's a buyer for it right now, and it's so active, as she said, you're going to get 4 and 5 offers immediately.
But what if you don't want to put your house on the market at during the holidays? I mean, can you still do, is it okay to wait?
Of course, yeah. I think, you know, the best time to put your house on the market is when you are personally ready to put your house on the market and when the house is ready. And I think there's certain challenges for listing your house in the winter. You've got to make sure you're ready to make that the entryway is clear and safe. You've got to have a plan for the snow. So it is a little more difficult. But I think on the plus side, anyone that's coming to look at your house is pretty darn serious. If someone's coming December 20th, they probably need to buy a house.
Right.
Whereas someone coming to look March 10th might just be starting their home search.
Let's see. Doug in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Doug.
Hi. So you've been talking about houses in the 280s and, you know, 200 plus. And I'm curious what the real estate market in Ohio or the real estate developers, et cetera, are doing for low-income families that, you know, are making, you know, $30,000, $40,000 a year, maybe $50,000, but there's no way they're going to be looking at a $280,000 house. They're looking at, you know, $100,000 houses at most. Or, you know, I live in Linden, mm-hmm. and we could afford to live in a higher-priced neighborhood, but, you know, I watched a house across the street from us that was for sale for $40,000, and it finally sold at, you know, after like 6 months on the market. And it, you know, it's like a 3-bedroom, 1.5-bath, nice house. And, you know, the neighborhood isn't Upper Arlington, but it's a decent neighborhood. The folks around are nice. Why aren't those houses selling like hotcakes?
Well, that's something, Rob Vogt, you were talking about earlier. Yeah. There's a challenge is there.
I think it's a perception problem. Columbus schools have always been a challenge quite realistically. You know, do you want to put your kids into that? And that's one of the reasons suburban school districts have been so attractive is the risk is lower. There's perceptions of crime in some of these neighborhoods when there really isn't a crime issue. And You know, who's your neighbors? You know, there's the diversity that some of the neighborhoods offer. There's some things that folks aren't particularly attracted to. And then the housing stock, as Cynthia was pointing out earlier, the fact that a $40,000 house probably does require some major improvements to it to make it desirable. And, you know, the home remodeling market is so hot right now. Trying to find somebody to do that kind of work is a challenge at this point. So
it's rough.
You know, I think it's a lot easier for a household to move into a ready-to-occupy house in a suburban neighborhood where your risk is lower. So, but I completely agree with the caller. The fact is that we don't have a lot of affordable choices for many households. And that's one of the things we really haven't talked about yet is that some of the lowest income households are really challenged to find housing right now, quality housing, and it's just not out there.
And find financing to buy, too.
I don't think the financing would be a problem. As long as the property's livable, there's not a problem with that. So I think the financing, you can go conventionally with little if you're a first-time home buyer with 3% down. So conventional came out with a new product that kind of competes neck and neck with FHA.
Okay.
It's a smaller down payment than FHA, but as long as you're a first-time home buyer, you'll be fine with going conventional.
Are we pretty much through that wave of defaults that prevented people from getting financing for another home?
Yeah, I think that's – I hope that's going to be beyond us for many, many years. I hope we never go back to those days. There's too many stops in place, meaning there's something called a QM, a qualified mortgage, where you have to actually verify if this person hits this ratio that they're going to win. In other words, we can't exceed a 45% of your total income towards a debt load. So there's a lot of stops in there that hopefully people won't have a foreclosure. But there's going to be things happening to people, losing a job, hospital, you know, accidents are going to happen. So there will be foreclosures, but they're going to be more controlled.
And also, you know, Cynthia, I'm thinking about people who are going to buy at that lower level. They may not have the income for upkeep. Does that keep people away from buying?
I think it can. I think a larger challenge probably is, like, last month, the average sales price in all of the different areas, the range was huge, $90,000 to the most affordable area to $600,000 for the most expensive area.
Uh-huh.
When you're in the under 200, if you've got a nice property for, let's say, $125,000, you're going to be competing with investors. You're going to be competing with cash because there are a lot of people in the market, investors in the market, that will want to buy that for a rental. So I think it's very difficult to be a buyer that's FHA, conventional, and the lower affordable prices when the property is attractive.
Yeah, good point, because we don't see a ton of it. We do it. But I think you're right. A lot of the investors will go in because at that price point, maybe they do need updates, et cetera. An investor goes in there and says, okay, I'll put $10,000 or $20,000 in it. I can get $800 rent. And that's where they make their money at. We see a lot. And that's also good for the neighborhoods.
Flipping thing.
Yeah, sometimes, because that brings the stabilization into the neighborhood. If you have an investor or investors coming in there and start updating these homes, it helps jumpstart the whole neighborhood. Would you agree, Rob?
Yeah, I would agree, Todd. But it has also been one of the reasons we've been so restricted on supply, in that we had so many foreclosures during the recession that a lot of companies went in and bought up houses that would have normally been sold are now being rented. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the fastest growing rental components of the overall rental housing market are families that are electing to rent their house instead of to buy the house. And some of that may be due to the lack of product that's out there, a desirable product. So they said, oh, let's just rent for now.
Right.
So,
Doug, thanks for that call. Bob in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. Great show as usual, Ann.
Thank you.
One question. What's going on with Hilltop? What's it going to take to develop top of the hill on the west side? Because it's been dead out here for a long time.
So you're out there then?
I am at the top of the hill.
Okay.
You know, I was just talking about this issue last week, in fact, Ann, and one of the things that I've been sort of predicting, I guess my next crystal ball, is that I think West Franklinton might be the next hot neighborhood in Columbus. When you think about where it's located, not East Franklinton, I'm talking about now west of Mount Carmel, west of 315, that has always had a bit of a reputation.
Will the development around Cosi give it that kind of a – will that – be part of it?
It will certainly help contribute to that. But I think the great thing about West Franklinton is the fact that it has such a cohesive collection of housing.
Yeah.
There hasn't been a lot of demolitions there. It's got some really interesting streets. It has a commercial district along Broad Street that could become sort of a Short North type place.
Mm-hmm.
And most important, well, two more things. One is it's got sort of defined boundaries. You have I-70, you have 315, you've got the Scioto River, kind of giving it a real neighborhood feel. And then you've got the mobility. You've got folks that have said, you know, East Franklinton is desirable. I'd like to live there. And then they find out there's nothing available. So West Franklinton is the next logical neighborhood in which they could make that that move towards. So I think when we're talking about the Hilltop, it's important to have mobility patterns that sort of encourage its development. And if we had the kind of this positive development in West Franklinton, then the next logical step is out towards the Hilltop. So I think it's coming to Hilltop. It's just going to take a little bit longer than I think the caller probably wants at this point.
But I was thinking also, okay, we get down with the downtown development. Are those builders thinking, once we're done with that development, we're just going to go away? Or are they going to continue to develop and maybe go further out and further out?
As long as there's demand.
Yeah, right. I mean, if you look around downtown, all of the neighborhoods are experiencing an incredible degree of revitalization. You know, Southside around Children's Hospital, mm-hmm. If you haven't been down there recently, it's incredible.
You know, Bob, thanks a lot for that call because it does raise another issue. The Columbus Dispatch reported in November that the city of Columbus-owned land bank properties are becoming eyesores now. That's just not moving the properties through the process fast enough. Some are saying that the program is becoming part of the problem, and they're just sitting on these properties now. That's got to be part of this conversation.
Absolutely, Anna. And I think it's important for the land bank to kind of take a strategic look at the properties that they have. There are some properties that should be demolished right now to kind of help.
But they're 300 a year now.
Well, that's right. And they do need to move that process faster. The problem is that if they simply give them away without consideration of how it's going to impact the neighborhood, it isn't going to help that neighborhood. So they have to think about each site specifically and figure out a strategy for that house. And I think that now that we've got so much interest in downtown and near downtown neighborhoods, they could probably accelerate that process fairly easily to get rid of a number of those properties.
I just hate to see them sit around for so long that at one point they might be usable.
Yeah, salvageable.
And salvageable, yeah. And then they just sit for so long that they have to just knock it down.
Well, it would be an interesting show to have the land bank folks on to talk about what those strategies are and how they go through the process of getting rid of those houses. I suspect there's probably a lot of listeners that would be interested in one mm-hmm. of those houses right now.
We have done that, and I would advise, you know, people, if you're interested in that, to go to our archives and check it out, download the podcast. The land bank would be the key word you'd have to be shooting for there. I want to turn to Lisa now in Columbus. You're on the air. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I'm a little bit of a different demographic. I am 58. I have a house in Minerva Park. I want to sell it and then move into a condo. The question is, I looked at Realtor.com, and it went from 4 pages of possibilities in the spring to being 4 on one page as of this morning.
Not a lot out there.
We don't want to go.
Not a lot out there for condos. Cynthia McKenzie?
What I would probably advise in this case is get ready to get ready. Make sure that you are seeing what's out there so you are familiar and you know the right condo for you when it does come available. Supply will go up in the spring. And make sure that you've talked to a lender and you've got your plan in place so that when you do identify that property, you're ready to roll. There'll be more.
This is an issue, though, of having that down payment for the condo ready.
Possibly. I don't know her exact situation, but there's, you know, sometimes people will borrow off their house for the down payment if it doesn't affect their debt to income ratio. Now I'm going into Todd's world.
Yeah. No, but you could get a line. You can get a line of credit against your house and use that for the down payment prior to. Because I go back to what we said earlier, probably going contingent on the sale of her home in Minerva Park is probably not going to be advisable, especially if the product increases back to 4 pages. Okay. Well, right now, with 4 pages, there may be more opportunity to go contingent.
Mm-hmm. And she sounds like the perfect candidate for what I was talking about earlier, to elect to rent for a little bit until you can find...
What's the rush?
Right. What's the rush? And there's enough choices out there, and maybe she might like renting for a while. That gives her the flexibility to make that decision on where she wants to live, how she wants to live, and what kind of product she wants to live in.
Right.
That's a good idea, because then it takes away the contingency issue of having to sell your home.
But realty agents are like, wait.
No, 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 no. I think it's a great idea, but not everybody's willing to move twice. There's a lot of headache and expense with that. That being said, a lot of people do move twice. And another thing that we've seen with the trying out, I've had a couple clients that have been relocating here that have found Airbnbs for 2 months. So they'll come here, do an Airbnb, a long-term Airbnb for a couple months in a neighborhood, and have that their home-based search.
Okay. All right, Lisa, thanks a lot for that call. Email from Tiffany. She says, I'm wondering what Cynthia's thoughts are for someone considering becoming a licensed real estate agent in today's market. We continue to hear of the low inventory and an increase in agents in the city. Any thoughts?
Wow, that's a big question. I think it would be a good way to start to talk to a couple of realtors, get some opinions. You know, I think becoming a realtor, I would never discourage anyone to become a realtor if that's what they're really interested in. It would be a difficult time to start, but I think that's probably true of any market. Starting back in the recession was probably a difficult time to start.
Yeah.
But I do think if you've got that passion, if you're a business sense and savvy and love working 7 days a week, I think go for it.
Having no free time, answering the phone all hours a night.
Right, exactly. Thank you, Tiffany, for that email. I'll get to some more emails and some more calls when we return. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You could email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about the real estate market in Central Ohio. It's booming still, but that creates its own set of challenges. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Still with us to talk about the trends in the real estate market. President of Helpbringer Mortgage Services, Todd Helpbringer, also a real estate analyst at Vogt Strategic Insights, Rob Vogt, and Worthington-based realtor and with Keller Williams Capital Partners. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you have a question, I'm turning now to Joanne in New Albany. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
You bet.
Actually, calling to give a shout-out to Todd, because I can't think of anyone better qualified, harder working, and more patient to teach the process than he. He does a great job, and thank you, Todd.
Thank you, Joanne. Thank you.
How much did you...
Yeah, I know. Checks in the mail.
So,
Joanne, did you have a question?
You know, every question I ever have, I kind of turn to Todd, and he always answers all the questions. Like, you know, guy works 24/7. I can't, you know, I have a lot of questions all the time, and he's incredibly patient with me.
Okay. All right, Joanne.
Thank you, Joanne.
Thanks a lot
Thank
for that call. Yeah. Tony in Dublin, you're on the air. Hi, Tony.
Oh, hi, Ann. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
My question is in regard to supply. As opposed to demand. You know, your guest had mentioned that demand will remain high. I wonder if they think in the coming year if the supply is going to start to catch up to demand.
Well, certainly on the apartment side it will. In fact, I think we're anticipating that we're going to see some rent specials out there this coming spring and into summer as this surge of new product is released into the marketplace. So I think on the rental side, we will see supply catch up to the demand. The fortunate thing is I don't see it to be a long-term problem, that eventually then the demand will catch up with that supply. So it's kind of that ebb and flow that we always see in most real estate markets. I do think, however, on the for sale side, that it will continue to be a challenge because of the cost of land, the cost of development, the cost of regulations, the cost of materials are all those things that I don't see changing in the coming years. And I think it's going to be a real challenge to deliver a new product for less than, as we've talked about, for $250,000. And the market begins to thin out as you get up into that price point. So I think on the for sale side, it's going to be a real challenge over the next 24 months at least.
The thing you could do with condos is, or apartments, is go up, 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 up.
That's
We only have so much land. And
yeah, but they're getting kind of picky about how far up they want you to go, too.
But still, they may ask to build, 50 homes. How many acres is that going to take you can have 50 units pretty easily in an apartment complex.
What about things like co-ops? They're very familiar in New York City and Chicago, but not so much here.
No, they aren't. And that's kind of a legal ownership situation. And I don't know Ohio law enough to know if they are an acceptable alternative, but you simply don't see them in Ohio. It's sort of a condominium type ownership situation where you own a portion of the building. I think that's probably in areas where the demand is so high that this is a way to minimize your costs when you have a co-op situation. So it probably isn't applicable in Ohio.
Okay. Tony, thanks a lot for that call. Email from Lou. What do your guests think will happen to downtown condos and apartments that are so desirable because of tax abatements? Who will want them once the tax abatement expires? Are we setting ourselves up for issues down the line with tax abatements?
I know we've talked about that. My concern is right now they're buying them with these abatements. What happens to the value when those abatements, peel off?
Yeah. And it's aged as well.
No, you're right.
10 or 15 years down the road.
Mm-hmm. Right. And prices will adjust to reflect that, I think. But I think that the direction, at least right now, is that downtown and the neighborhoods around downtown are so desirable with so many different types of amenities that the impact should be minimized, assuming we maintain the kind of the current status quo in terms of interest. It will affect prices. And I live in the short north and I'm offended by the fact that I'm paying my taxes every month, yet properties nearby aren't.
Do you think they still need abatements down there?
Well,
that's the big debate.
No, I agree.
A lot of people think the city's just way overextended itself on that score.
Well, in certain neighborhoods, I think that's true, Anne. I think the city is recognizing that they have probably gone overboard in some situations. So I think you're going to see some of that being peeled back and put into other neighborhoods that really do need to be encouraged for development.
Email from Mark and Cynthia. This might be up your alley. We're thinking of listing our home in Blacklick, 10 years old, in the mid to upper 400s. One agent told us that rather than staging, it might be best to show it completely empty, new carpet, spotlessly clean. The house is very bright with large windows. What do your guests think?
That is up my alley. I think I'd have to see the house to actually know. Mm-hmm. That being said, I think staging is wonderful when you have a floor plan that's really hard or difficult to imagine. I think vacant houses are unforgiving. So I like that I heard that he was going to have spotless carpet.
Yeah.
You also have to make sure that the walls are painted and there's nothing to focus on when there's no furniture. So it really does have to be perfect. I'd definitely clean the windows right before you list as well. And again, I think there's no right answer. There's probably two right answers in this case. And what's going to be most convenient for this home seller? What are they most comfortable with? So I also would say a house that's half lived in and half not puts everybody a little bit off kilter when you're walking through the house. The buyers start to try to figure out, is this a divorce? Where are they?
The bedroom's set up still. But...
And then some of the buyers will go to the refrigerator and go, they're not living here. So I think it distracts from what you're trying to accomplish if it's half lived, half not.
Is it tough for the clients to visualize what the house will look like empty?
It depends on the furniture, right? Sometimes the furniture's of a certain era or a certain age.
Good point.
Another thing that can be in a furniture is like pet smells. You don't want to have that either.
Are you seeing more virtual reality technology impacting the selling market yet?
I've seen it. I haven't really had anyone ask for it yet when they're listing their property. to say, hey, can we put furniture in that house? Yeah. So I don't see a lot of it yet. Who knows? Maybe that's coming.
You mean where they see if their furniture fits or how, what
right.
they, you know, that,
or
what they need or what they'll need, or
like a picture of a room, and then you can tell, like a computer puts like couches and mm-hmm. end tables and yeah.
Cool.
So again, I think it distracts from what you're trying to accomplish sometimes because people are like, oh, that's staged. That's photos. I wonder if I could do that.
Huh. Okay. Yeah. Email from Max. I think we get one of these every time. Columbus needs to start moving away from suburban sprawl toward high-density ownership. When will developers start pushing for the sort of infrastructure and government support, i.e. mass transit, flexible zoning, and high-density ownership that define metropolitan areas instead of the continued argument over trying to move up and become homebuyers into the existing suburban mentality?
Wow.
Yeah, I know. That's a lot, Max.
Yeah. Well, it is. But, you know, that's the whole thing that Columbus 2050 is talking about, Ann, that if we continue on the rate of urban sprawl that we're continuing, it eats up just gobs and gobs of acreage that we simply can't service. So if we're going to expect a higher density and more people living close to the center city, we do have to create better infrastructure for those folks. I mean, transportation is one of the major ones, and you know, we're one of the only major cities without rail transportation. It's incredible to me that to think that we haven't developed this yet,
and with nothing on the horizon.
With really, yeah. Now, you know, Morpsey and the city has started a study to look at some of these corridors, but I know it's been discussed in the past. But the other issue has to do with schools and the fact that, you know, if I've got a family with two kids, do I really want to live in a condominium on a 8-story building that's close to downtown? Probably not. I mean, if you talk to the home builders, their market is for a traditional family that wants to live in the suburbs and go to good school. So, you know, it's that I agree with the question that we need to encourage higher density housing downtown, but the reality is what the market really wants is the suburban tract housing that have been attractive to folks for the past 50 years.
Michael in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Ann. This is Mike. I just wanted to comment on the amount of new rentals being built around Clintonville, such as the Deco on Indianola, the restaurant, the Bear Burger, they have condos above that. And then they're building another condo down the street. I just feel like it's creating a shortage of housing when I feel like less families want to rent than you know, they want to buy a house. They don't want to rent.
Hmm. And you're saying these are rentals?
Yeah, they are rentals. Yeah.
Okay. Well, what is going on in Clintonville? That there used to be just owner-occupied, you know.
And Clintonville is a very desirable, close-in suburban area. And there's been a lot of households who have been there for years and years and years. And you know what it's like to live in a two-story house that has been built, you know, 70, 80 years ago. It requires maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
But when you want to stay in the neighborhood, you don't want to move into another house. So what are your choices? Well, you know, the Deco is one example that you have an apartment close by to where you've always lived for the past 20 years, and it's maintenance free, and you can still be with your friends and go to your favorite restaurants. And, you know, I think it's a great compliment to Clintonville to have those kinds of housing choices so close by. And as we've talked about this morning, there's some folks who want to rent and there's some folks who want to own. So condominiums can also.
It hasn't affected the demand for buying housing in Clintonville.
No.
Worthington's got kind of the same problem. I mean, it doesn't have enough places to move to when you want to move out of your house.
Right. We have the apartments at the Worthington Mall, mm-hmm. which they've done some short-term rentals as well that people have been able to bridge the gap between buying and selling. But we could definitely use more ownership opportunities.
More condominiums.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. For sure.
Yeah.
For the empty nesters.
Any news about what's happening in that development by the children's home?
I'm going to pass to Rob on that.
Rob, anything?
I haven't heard anything yet.
Nothing.
The Methodist home.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
There's been a number of proposals, but nothing that's been fully accepted by Worthington.
Nope, I'm not going to touch that one.
Okay, well, thanks for that call. Let's talk just briefly about this. There was another survey that kind of interested me. It said that 1 out of 3 buyers will regret the tiny home trend. What do we mean by tiny home? And for one thing, there is no zoning for tiny homes in Columbus right off the bat. There's no nothing like that. But do you get any demand for that, people who want really small houses?
I've had a handful of calls of people wanting to construct their own tiny homes someplace, but finding a lot in Clintonville to do a tiny home or in Worthington, not many lots for tiny homes.
I wonder if the zoning would even allow that.
That's exactly what I'm wondering is about zoning,
And but I do think buyers are making their choices of smaller spaces, one, because they're forced to because of price, and two, less is more. I think being close in versus the suburbs, but there's still plenty of people that need more space if you have four kids or if you have a home office. So, but tiny homes, I don't see a lot of them in Columbus.
And I think one of the challenges is to actually develop a tiny house that's functional. And there's a lot of definitions for tiny houses. I mean, we see all the home improvement shows that talk about living in 300 square feet.
I can't even watch those.
Or 180 square feet. Yeah, exactly. But I think there is a market for a small house that's highly detailed, that has all of the upscale amenities, that's landscaped really well. And we've really not done anything like that. You might see Epcon as an example that has done a smaller house in a well-detailed landscaped site. But I haven't seen a subdivision done like that. And I think there's probably a market for something like that. The other piece of that, Ann, is the micro apartments. And that's probably worth another show to talk about how much interest is in micro apartments in Columbus.
Everything's built in. Everything's
And you're living in 220 square feet. How long can you live there?
I don't know.
But I also think that's part of the loveliness of Columbus. We're not New York. We're not Chicago.
Right.
We're not San Francisco or D.C. That's part of the reason people choose to live here, so they don't have to live in a 200 square foot
shoebox.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Joanna in Columbus.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I appreciate your taking my call. I wanted to talk about, as far as realtors misrepresenting the square footage of a piece of property.
Why would they do that? No, not Cynthia, but why? What might inspire a realtor?
I think I probably can speak to that.
Yeah.
So when we load a property on the MLS, which is a multiple listing service, it auto-populates from the county auditor. So whatever the county auditor has as the square footage, so if my house is 2,048 square feet on the Franklin County auditor, that is what will go into that field, and that is a locked field.
Okay.
So sometimes there are mistakes in Franklin County auditor. Then there's a separate field called ATFLS, which is actual total functional living space. And that is where we can add a finished basement or maybe a four-season room. What happens is then Zillow might use the second number, the ATFLS, as the main square footage on their site, which does get very confusing for home buyers. Did that answer your question at all?
No.
Perfect.
Okay, well,
sorry.
You're talking about misrepresenting the amount of area in an apartment. When you say realtor, are you talking about the apartment complex manager people?
No, I'm talking about realtors who are, because I live in a condominium complex, and there are several condos that are for sale. And I checked out as far as what was stated in the realtor's description. And with the Franklin County Auditor office, it shows, like, for instance, my condo has 1,224 square feet.
Okay.
And there's a couple of realtors that have placed listings that are similar to mine.
Yeah. We're running out of time, Joanna. I'm kind of rushing you. I don't mean to, but we're just about out of time. So you're saying that, I guess, saying that they're just not they can't be it because she already knows how big the it is. I'm sorry, Joanna. We don't have time to take your question. I apologize. I do have to say goodbye to Rob Vogt, real estate analyst at Vogt Strategic Insights. Rob, thanks for joining us again.
You're welcome.
Also, Todd Helpbringer, president of Helpbringer Mortgage Services. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Ann.
And Cynthia McKenzie, Worthington-based realtor with Keller Williams Capital Partners. Thanks to you.
Thanks, Ann.
Thanks, everybody, for your calls. Thanks for your emails. And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.